DCT Audio. The art of good listening.
You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
I am Krishna Thapa. I was born in the lap of the Himalayas in the nearby the Annapurna mountain. I was grown up as a monk and for age 19. And obviously my granddad, we lost him in Second World War. My dad was a failed Gurkha. He tried many years to join in the Gurkhas. He couldn't. When I was pregnant and my parents dreamed me joining the Gurkhas in Nepal, joining the Gurkha was one of the most prestigious job we can have. And especially over the generation, it's like we're serving with the Gurkhas, Indian Gurkhas, eventually British Gurkha. Then I was failed first time to join in the Gurkhas as well, 1995. But you know what? Then my realization is going through the spending 3 months in camp, British camp in Pokhara, and I find the result I failed the first time. That is actually I passed in my realization mind. So basically my perspective mind, I realized the guys on the left and the right both passed and joined, flew to the UK, and I packed my bag and I went my village back in Annapurna. And actually I realized I can do this thing because I have proof, guys, both my side, we are living together 3 months. I know exactly what we are going through. They passed and I had a huge reflection, meditation in the mountain. I realized it's me. I always thought in my mind I wasn't good enough to join the British Gurkha. But once I realized, you know, they're saying seeing is believing. When I realized my friends on the left and right passed, and I was like, oh, they passed. I think I can pass. Then, and that day when I realized, and every morning, 4 a.m., wake up, we call the very famous Doko race, which is like equivalent to a backpack in the UK, carrying the 30 kg. And I was running like mountain for whole year preparation. And second time, and I passed very high percentage. Joining the Gurkhas for 7 years and been called by the OC in his office and said, oh, we're going to send trial for the first ever Gurkhas SAS selection because no one has done by then.
So in the great traditions of the British Army, you were volunteers.
Yeah, pretty much. And yeah, and since then, joining the 2003 and almost like 19 years with the regiment in the SAS. Now I'm retired 2021. And now I'm working with, you know, like veteran and PTSD and running my own podcasts like Eastern Philosophy and Western Recipe in a way. And here I am now, and great to meet you here.
Before we started the podcast, about how difficult this interview was for me to plan, because I knew we would be going off at tangents, and straight away, within the first sentence, and you said something I didn't realize, that your first attempt at getting in the Gurkhas, you failed. It struck me how important is failure when it comes to success.
So one of the things I realized, Dave, is in life, there is always situation, isn't it? Like you're just going, leaving the kids to the school every day. There is some drama, situation, driving car, drama, everything is situation. I think from my realization is that every situation, either we became wounded or wiser. So failing is actually, like, that's why I said, you know, like maybe in my perspective level, I fail, but my realization, actually, I can do this thing. You know, it has to come from within ourselves. Whatever we achieve, dream, desire, love, emotion, depression, anxiety, it's actually come from within us. So I think if we knew that, then if we have a positive mindset, and that actually just lesson learned, isn't it? We collect whatever the gone mistake, realization, and work for it. And Actually, it's not a fail, isn't it? But how it is very important, isn't it? That's the time. Yeah.
Why do you think we're afraid to fail?
It's a great question, Dave. Because we are in the, you know, like, especially UK is like one of the most advanced country in the world. In so many ways, we are advanced in intellectual mind. We got the great facilities, you know, AI is leading in all the science and technology leading. But as a human being, we are almost living in our mindset, you know, so much in the mindset, but not in a life set. Because we're living so much into the mind and not as a human in a life, and we haven't got the inspiring, you know, like story or wisdom to learn from our generation that we are human.
That's why failure hurts, isn't it? Because it's our ego that's hurt.
Yes, 100%. Because if we stress our body, the minute we are start penetrating our mind and energy, then it's hard to get off. Because we are almost, like I say, almost living in our mind too much.
Without failure on your first attempt, you would not have done so well on the second.
100%. 100%. And also, I wouldn't be standing here and sharing this story with you. You know, my life will different, you know, thing. Actually, that's why, you know, like we call failure. Failure or past is some gave that term, isn't it? But in a lifetime, we are just either we learn and good at it, come over our identity and ego and accept, you know, then realize, oh, first thing is in my mind, I always think I'm not good enough. Second thing is I wasn't trained enough, because the minute I put myself, oh, I can't do it, then how can I give 100%, isn't it? Then second time when I realize when I'm a failure, actually, you know what? I can do this one. Then everything is follow on, isn't it? Your training is positive, your mindset is positive, and your approach is positive. And I think that's what changed my life.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I know you talked about perspective a lot and different perspectives. And the obvious thing that comes to my mind is in the US, you know, to be a success is celebrated. Mm. Whereas perhaps in the UK, being successful isn't to be celebrated. Mm. It's a strange opposite view.
I think that's where our culture and society, and also, you know, one of the things I really realize is that the people we are connected with, isn't it? So, and like really close friend, the time we spend with, I think, you know, until years age 19, before I joined the Gurkhas in mountain, like barefoot school and living in pretty much nothing and still happy. You know, people are still happy. And now we came here and whole thing is different. It's buzzing, isn't it? Like, oh, it's been great. You know, I think I still can be happy, but I think that's where we need to find the balance and who we are and where we, you know, like spending time. One of the greatest thing my realization is, it is very important us to driven our intellectual, academic education and, you know, achieving, but also, there is a time to write, oh, we need to ground, we need to time spend our love on, you know, go to the nature, you know, be the part of who we are as a human being, both biologically and genetically as well. I think this is what definitely we missing in the society at the moment.
We've got lots to talk about. We last spoke in December 2022, I think, in South Wales. We'd just come down from Penarvan, the Curtis Palmer program, and I believe you've been quite busy since then. What have you been up to?
Yeah, very busy, in fact. Since we talk, obviously, as you are aware, I was leading the first double amputee above knees Everest expedition.
Now successful.
All can I say is I think we've been very lucky and fortunate, and we've been very, you know, gratitude for all the people like you and Curtis Palmer and, you know, all the big charity, you know, supporting behind SIM for Harry project. And also, I think it's great news for the veteran and amputee and disability people and for the Gurkhas and in overall for the Great Britain and Nepal. We've been very, again, fortunate and lucky. Everyone is back in here and safe. And I think that's probably the one most important thing for me.
I think that's all you can say, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everything else is a bonus. But and we'll talk about the expedition more in detail later on. It's really good to see you, and thank you for inviting me into your home. I'm sat here at your table. I've got my computer going and I'm drinking a cup of tea out of a SAS badged cup, which kind of is a good metaphor for the conversation we're having. I know you've talked about your childhood previously in many interviews, but just give me a little bit of an insight into your childhood and the Buddhist culture that you were born into.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, those people who are aware, Nepal is obviously very mixed and the culture, not only in the, you know, like traditional level, but also the metaphor as like, you know, like geologically as well, from sea level to highest. Actually, I was born in the jungle, born in the tree. In our culture, I wasn't allowed to born in mom house. Mom house, I had to born in a dad house. So, you know, actually, I did a little bit of research on that, and it's all about the protecting the DNA, you know, like protecting the genetical side, you know, like, and biological side of the aspect, so that later on, which is very fascinating, you know.
Oh, you were literally born in a tree?
Yeah, literally born in jungle, because my, you know, like my mom, I was the eldest son, and my mom, when she became sick, giving the, you know, like labor for me, and she just basically run from the my dad house, because as being a mom, she wants to, when she's not feeling well, she run to, oh, I want to go and see my mom. So she ran through the jungle, which is, I think it's about 10-15 kilometers through the jungle, where's my dad house and my mom house. She just literally run overnight. And when she's giving me labor, and she gone into the mom house and eventually made it, and then they were like, oh, you are not allowed to born in my house. So drag her out, drag her out from the house, and like put it on, you know, like, because it's in Nepal, those who have been, especially in that, you know, like on like hill and mountain region, it's like jungle. And all the tribe, like our tribe, the Gurkhas tribe, they live on the top of the small mountain.
She never made it to the Gurkha village. It was like...
yeah. And the other great interesting thing was then, you know, like until the 11 days, we call the Norwan. That means, I think it's like Pasmin here. You know, when 11 days, they do the ritual. And so until 11 days, we had to sit under the tree.
So you literally were born in the mountain?
Yeah, literally born outside.
So what month were you born?
I was in September, yeah. September.
So is that going to be winter time in Nepal?
Yeah, pretty much winter time. Yeah, September the 5th. It's so my birthday.
That must have been pretty harsh for your mum, and yes, kind of shows the physical resilience that perhaps you were later to show.
Yeah.
And you said you were the oldest son in your family.
Yeah.
In the Buddhist culture, that has certain responsibilities, doesn't it?
Yeah, huge responsibility. So my father, again, obviously failed Gurkha, so he joined the Nepalese force after that one, and he was away all the time. And then the responsibility in our culture is the eldest son has to take over all the ritual, you know, like in traditional perspective. And my daily routine is from, I remember age 4, had a cold shower in the morning and changed the dress, like according to the dress, you know, like white, red, different, yellow. So that's actually to do with you know, like, so people, a lot of people call it with the, you know, like chakra or the energy system in the body, and that's actually directly coordinate with the planets, you know, Mars, Earth, you know, Pluto. So according to that, they 7 chakras and 7 planets. So we had to 7 days, so every day has to wake up, cold shower, change the dress, and like worship the snake, worship the cow, worship the, you know, stone and sky, water, you know, like all the ritual we had to go through. Yeah, that's kind of my grown-up childhood.
So it was very much a life of ritual, really.
Yeah. We have to follow, every household has to follow, and then there is like village, and village elder will come and check, and if we're not doing something, and they were like, oh, you know, what's going on, you know, like kind of check on up us. So, you know, by that time, honestly, I hated, you know, a young guy, and had to do, and then we are not allowed to eat until we finish our, you know, like ritual, and every day is fasting.
So Krishna didn't find enlightenment during those early years.
I hated my, I was like, what the hell, I'm doing this cold shower every day, like why? And I used to complain to the mom, and she's like, no son, you have to do it.
Because, so you did question why you were doing it.
Yeah, I was like, I used to ask, you know, like young kids, I used to ask a very random question to my mom, my poor mom. I feel like so sad now. I used to ask her, why am I doing this one? And she's just like, oh, you know, just get on with your life and don't go and start worshipping the cow.
So going back to ritual then, in the West, we could perhaps describe ritual as consistency and persistency. And those are two important qualities.
You know what? I think it is really interesting, you know, when you're looking at, like, let's say in the UK, because somehow I still go every Sunday church here. And one of the thing I realize is either we go in the temple or either we go into the being a monk, spending the days in the monarch or in the mountain or a cave or in the being a Muslim in the, you know, mosques. One thing I realize is the common thing we do is everyone sit down. And everyone is so positive, you know, and then obviously that is the very fundamental of human being, and try to, you know, realize just kind of everything, so much goes in the head, so much going, like work. But going there, present, sit down is the greatest gift we can. After that, if you want to realize anything to do in life, first thing is we need to sit down, you know, and then breathe and then be silence. Be quiet, then we can talk about, then we can start, you know, analyzing our life, because otherwise we can't. I think I was in very fortunate position and served with the finest guy.
I don't have answers to anything, to be honest with you. And I think if people were honest, perhaps most people don't. But I think what I do know is that the universe is in everybody. A lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah.
When you talk about being quiet, mm-hmm. when you're quiet, that's when you listen.
My culture and realization is we're always looking for the peace and always talking, try to learn something. Actually, you know, more we learn and more we became activating and perceiving so much information, then our mind became a lot more busier. And then how can we find the peace within us, within the mind, when we're actually active? In order to find the peace in the mind, is the only way is to realize and sit down, isn't it? Be with the thing. I think that is the greatest thing. And that's where the church, mosques, or temple come up, you know? Just tell the people, come and sit down.
So with all that in mind,
yeah,
what makes a Gurkha such a good soldier within the British Army?
When you look at the fundamental of the discipline, fundamental of the activity, and the fundamental of the living us in the moment, breathing is a key fundamental part, and especially for shooting, isn't it? And what you do when you do the meditation, when you do the culture and society, what happened when we do the cold shower? Enhance breathing. That is the liver, isn't it? When you are immersed into the cold, not only cold water, yeah. cold environment, the liver produce so-called survival punch, you know, for the warm. That will change the whole dynamic of human energy system and, you know, like health. In Nepal, still the 90% people goes on the temple or on the church. You know, it's the only country still in the world.
Yes.
People have that faith. I don't call, you know, like maybe Nepal is very diverse, and like we got now a lot of Christian and a lot of Buddhists and Hindus and Muslim. I think it's like all the Westerner, they call it a safe haven. You know, they go there and it's so easy going and people live in harmony these days, in the 21st century. And I find the girls, which I school together, and she married the guy from Hong Kong. And she's like, no, she gone back to the village. She's like, I asked her question, how on earth? She's like, you know what, Chris? I'm so happy in the culture and society in the mountain rather than in Hong Kong.
Well, those of us in the West may struggle to understand that. I know in the Buddhist culture, sacrifice through adversity, you obviously mentioned the liver, and so physically.
Yes. Yeah.
Nepalese men are physically resilient.
Yeah.
Because of the environment that
absolutely
been brought in.
Yeah.
But also, it is a hard life from what you've said.
Yeah.
And there is adversity there. So that, I suspect, will give you a certain mindset to survive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the especially all the Gurkhas, I think we have been in so many levels, we kind of, we born in the mountain and we born, you know, in the cultural traditional, lot of new, even myself growing up, I hate it. But when you go to the life, you know, life lesson, and the culture and society try to teach you all about the life. And then now, you know, like that's what I realized, you know, in the battlefield, you know, in the wartime, when I'm going through so many dark places, when you realize to waking up and realization is that we need that, you know, the lifelong lesson and try to understand the culture and society and the grown up. And that's what I start understanding, not only the culture, society, and also the you know, scientific fact, what it does to my body and what it's trying to think. I think that's probably my greatest gift and for myself. And that's what I like to share, you know, and it's actually everything what we think bad is not actually, it's not so bad, you know.
Well, that is interesting. Why do you think then, and you mentioned the girl from your village that married somebody from Hong Kong but wanted to remain in Nepal. I know we've taught that your wish is to ultimately one day go back to Nepal. Why do people want to return to a life that was so full of adversity?
Because a lot of us in the so-called the modern world or the 21st century, everyone living in their identity, everyone living in their so-called ego in a way, it is very important, but also one of my greatest realizations, maybe through the being grown up in culture and being a monk in Nepal, is that I realized there is actually two minds. You know, one is the mind we through our sensation and all the senses and the mind. But actually, the love and the emotion through our love to the parents and kids, for the job, for any friends, those are pretty much nothing to do with the sensation, isn't it? We can't see, taste, hear the love, or emotion, depression, anxiety. It has to come from the certain feeling level and vibration and energy. Hence, a lot of monks gave up their life spending happily in the mountain, in the cave, nothing. A lot of gurus from India goes to Nepal, single, whole life, because what they has gone is they have achieved in certain level of enlightenment through within themselves to realization is that. I think that's why, going back to your answer, is once you start realizing your true love and emotion of who you as a human being, then whatever I thought, whatever people thought about me, or whatever I thought about the people, it doesn't really exist. You know, it's just only our intellectual mind.
So I suppose that the first mind you described is perception, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Looking at everything through your own perception.
Yeah.
Which is false.
Yeah.
Because my perception is different to yours.
100%. 100%.
The second mind you describe, experiences that you have no control over.
Yes.
And no way of altering how they appear to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know you've talked previously that when you're in the Special Air Service, some of the your colleagues that you worked alongside, you described as some of the most compassionate and humble men. And I'm sure you've been in many life and death situations where perspectives and cultures, that's all stripped away, and you're down to that, what you talk about, that second mind, the purest form of experience. And I know you've talked about it previously, about an experience you had, I think it was in 2010 or 2013, whilst you were abroad on operations with the Special Air Service. And I think you'd just done an operation in a village, and as you would expect, there was a lot of carnage about. A 13-year-old girl came up to you. Just tell me about that.
Yes, in the target, going on the mission, during the, you know, like battlefield, like bullet coming to you, and, you know, like people, you know, dying each other. And then one girl and tapping on my shoulder and said, like, what are you doing here? But she's laughing. And I realized, you know what? I'm fighting for my life. I'm fighting for my friend's life here. And now kids are run around. And then she come and hold my hand, start really, really crying. And then that's like, oh, you kind of, I lost my father. You know, you killed my father. And she cried. And actually, you know, I cry as well. And then that smile is gone. And I just kind of wake up myself. I lost, you know, somewhere like three human beings. And I wake up and I say, like, it's like, oh, I can't cry here. You know, I'm in battlefield with a proper, you know, mindset and thing. And we did our, you know, thing, and we flew back. And that last couple of days, I was into the, you know, like deep kind of meditation in a way. And why is that happen? And what is life does? And then actually, that's where I start, you know, going down to quite deep and dark places.
So do you think some of those sacrifices, and it sounds like you've made many in your life, have some of those sacrifices come with guilt and regret?
Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the incident now I'm going to share with you is one day, and going through the door, and then just about to get inside the door, one of the guy came and tapped my shoulder. You stay back. You got your missus and kids in the UK. I'm single. I'll go first. You know what? he gone inside in deep. And this is the ultimate sacrifice.
Do you feel guilty about that?
100%. That's what, you know, that's what I'm, we, you know, like my life is now, people talk about color. People talk about, you know, like, oh, this right and this thing. Those people who are talking, they never been into their deep side of life. Mm-hmm. They never learned the life, what it is, you know. Now, you know, seeing now I'm kind of living his legacy. You know, almost I'm living someone else's life. That's where the true and then the wisdom, you know, and inspiring for me to drive and to serve for the country and to serve for the friends and family who are dying for you.
It's a living epitaph.
Yes, absolutely. Having seen the my own British SS guy die for you. And now, you know, with the tears and then thing, I can't give it up. You know, that is the thing I need to do, my job. My responsibility is to protect and to share and serve. That only come from that incident, realizing that. And then here I am.
Somebody said once that the universe chooses you and gives you a set of glasses through which you see the universe.
Absolutely.
And once you put them on, you can never take them off.
100%. Absolutely. I think that's like you say, you know, like it's just the way you see and you perceive. It's, you know, like let's say now it's 8 billion people live in the world and everyone have their own 8 billion glasses, isn't it? How we see, how we feel is, I think that's why the, you know, like, you know, but once, you know what, the greatest thing is the realization and the truth is the only one. It's the same. You know, I think that's how can we tap into that truth path has to come from the wisdom and knowledge of our generation, of our teaching, which it can, you know, only be accessed, I guess, with the realization and understanding.
Well, going back to the mountains now, I don't think there's a mountain you haven't climbed. You've broken many records, and recently you went climbed Everest with Hari Buddha. It's the first double above knee amputee to summit Everest. Just describe that final ascent to me, if you can.
Yes, absolutely. I think, first of all, I just, maybe if you allow me, just I will just talk about the, I think we, not me, we hold, I think, about 9 world record, like all of them to do with the disability veteran and disability person. First Parkinson disease to climb the Mera Peak and Mount Blanc. First deaf blind and deaf guy climbed the Kilimanjaro. And triple double amputee summited the like Justin, Stefan and Harry Mount Blanc. First 2 times double amputee summit the Kira, you know, like Kilimanjaro. And now you know, like talking about the Harry's first ever double amputee summited the Mount Everest since like 70th years of, you know, Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing summited. All the camp are fixed. All the route are fixed. All the mindset are fixed. And I think the way I kind of plan for the Harry's, obviously seeing with the Harry, is that it's not going to work in normal way. So what is the way we can work for him? And I say, like, first thing is we need a everything, all the camp and all the people has to work for him. And second thing is, in order to do that, we need many manpower, you know, greater manpower, which is, I think we've been very lucky and fortunate, get it done. That's everything is in place. But they still, you know, challenging and mountain and weather is nothing goes as planned. And this plan didn't go as planned either. So we had like 10-man team, including me and Harry, for the summit beat. We were planned for that and we did everything perfect, you know, like acclimatization. I choose for the quietest area and we can have plenty more time. We actually wanted to just first, you know, behind the scene, I can now talk about it. We didn't publish anywhere. We said we're going to go in the Mera Peak, which is the other valley of the Mount Everest, sleeping in the 6,000 meter. That will give us a head start amongst other expedition and with the minimum crowd. And we planning to spend the 2-3 nights, 6,000 meters. That means we are good accommodation. We achieved that without doubt. We are very fortunate with weather. One of the greatest challenging we had was obviously kit for Harry. And we were doing a lot of work behind the scenes. And Even though, again, when you say about the summit going from the Camp 4, the death zone, 8,000 meter summit, everything was perfect. And we left the Camp 4. Normally, the people leave about midnight, 1 a.m. But we left 8 p.m. in the afternoon in our summit tomorrow, you know. But a lot of people don't know that actually Harry and our team, like, you know, like 10-man team were walking from Camp 3, 16 hours that same day. So he arrived actually at the Camp 4 about 2 and maybe 4 p.m. So normally people have good 6 to 7 hour rest. Yeah. And then we came and I can see Harry's like naked. And he asked me, oh, Chris, what's the plan? Are we going tonight or are we going tomorrow? I can see he's in his mind, he's thinking, oh, I wish I will have a few hours rest there. I got like, I said, no, bro, we're going to have to go today. I think the greatest thing with Harry, he got that mindset, you know, military mindset. He explained to me later on because he didn't say anything there because he had no choice. And so like, he just like, okay. And then he just literally zipped up for 2 hours. But the thing is 2 hours, you know, like in oxygen, because you got oxygen masks and you need to feed in, you know, you can't actually sleep. He just literally had 2 hours after 14 to 15 hours walking in, and he didn't realize he going for another 24 hours. So actually, so I think it's like he been walking for, you know, like, you know, 38, 40 hours, continuing the death zone. I said, we're going to have to leave the 8 p.m. unlike other people, because I knew that it's going to be slow. And I said, like, we're going to have eight supporting guide and Sherpas, each of them carry the 3 oxygen spare bottles. So that will give us enough oxygen to, you know, like contemplate it and come up anything to think. I think eventually we left about 9 or 10, you know, like all the flapping around and maxi, all the admin, and we gone. And we hit about the 8,500 meter, which is, we call the balcony. We left, remember, we left 8 p.m. and by the time we've been there, it's 8 or 9 a.m. and we are not even halfway off. And then Harry is with our team, Harry is the only one walking like 10 men, you know, like he's again going through. And the greatest trick is our other guys just like, it is for them, it's carrying and they can't move, you know, that's very slow. And they can't go up because we don't know. I wanted to make sure team stay intact for rescue or for help for Harry. And as a team, you know, it's a death zone. Either you within your team or you basically dead. As you go up, we see a lot of dead body. You know, it is the deadliest season in the history of the Everest. I never seen so many wandering people, you know, walking around the 8,000 meter mile off the track, just out of their mind. Hyper altitude, and they just like, they just in their mind, they just gone. You know, Jesus one, he was like, we just like, we can't do nothing. You know, we just watch people dying, you know, like people coming and hyper, you know, like all sort of thing. My yet again, we just like keep, don't look anything. I'm Harry will be just, Chris, you here? Yeah, just keep going, my, just keep going. He did brilliant, my, inspiring, you know, like mind blowing. We were very slow. I had time to reflect and how the team, this is, you know, as expedition leader, my core is that how the team doing, how we still in time, how the oxygen doing, how the food doing, how the team. And at the same time reflecting, you know, 6 years ago when Harry asked me if we can climb the Everest, and I said, we can try. And by then he couldn't actually stand up properly from bed and go to the toilet. Yeah. Struggling time. But now, I can see him walking on the, you know, above, and I just, you know, seeing him doing that, you know what? It's life is so much rewarding when you have, don't judge each other, you know, just give it a go, let help, you know. And I was like, oh my gosh, I was crying, you know, it's like, oh my God, it can be done. Anyway, then everything reality hit. And it's like, then one of the guys, one of the Sherpa come, I can see him with the experience, with the great, you know, military background and all the cold, he's down. He got severe hypothermia. It's like, he's carrying the oxygen bottle. The greatest thing we have in a team was everyone wanted to help. Everyone wanted to help the Harry. And we had a really good team. But yet again, and I have to be realistic, and I think the problem we have was Harry is working hard, but everyone is carrying a load, and their body over the, like, imagine now is 12 hours, we don't even gain like 300, 400 meter. And I said, like, I'm going to have to make some plan. I can't, if the one guide or Sherpa die, we're going to have to send four more guys to rescue him unless we're going to leave him die. We can't do that. Guys, listen up. I'm going to have to make a decision. That's what I stand up and give the proper, you know, QBO, like on the ground. This is what's going to happen. We're going to send the immediate two guys down because we cannot have a casualty in the mountain. Otherwise, we basically whole expedition will jeopardize. Then, right, two guys, first thing, drop your backpack, oxygen can go down. And so that actually they are in pair as well. One guy has a start frozen leg. You are fine. Just make sure you're safe. Go down, camp for, have a hot water, relax, and we will shout out when you come back with, you know, when you feel good, come back and act as a reserve. Then I have to say, right, to the Harris, right, this is God, what can happen, brother, because we got now two Sherpas down, we got six down. If in this space, this much of oxygen bottle, if you want to succeed safely, and if not, then if I go, then this much oxygen bottle we have, it's not gonna enough time. It's just time. It's just too slow. If I don't go, then actually my oxygen and then all the Sherpas can work for him, which is a must, you know, like potentially succeed. And I actually did quite a bit, you know, thinking about it. And I think, and also he's in a good hand because he and then four, you know, like five Sherpas, like multi-submitter. And one, like I said, one is most experienced submitter. Then I had to like trust, right? But however, don't be daft and don't be stupid, you know, on the mountain. We'll be still in comms. Then plan was then me and the one Sherpa stay and manning kind of, you know, OP from that 8,600 meter. And two of the guys were hide and think, go down to the base camp. And Harry and four team will continue because we can't see the summit and ridge line anyway. We know. Then I said like, yeah, plan, Harry, you better move now. There is no time to talk here. No time to emotion thing. This is the military mindset, Mike. We need to work on this until we can. And I think that's probably the what is the biggest thing, you know, has to make a decision. I knew that Harry is the driven force and everything has to work for him. I could have said, right, expedition over, or I will go and submit. It will have maybe take an hour for me to submit and come down, fly the flag. But you know what? Let's take a little bit judgment here. And it's, you know, it's worth taking a risk and me giving up kind of my, you know, dream, because I've already submitted anyway. And then, you know, like for me, it's like, it's okay. This is the right thing to do. And then like, and then we stay there. They're gone up. I think we stayed for maybe an hour. Normally in a historic pattern, every summit, they will have a couple of days bad weather and 24, 48 hours good weather, like really good, you know. I remember summiting with you know, no gloves, but my this year is like, you know, it wasn't like worse, but like just the wind constant. I think that's what a lot of problem have, because people are a little bit on the edge, you know, like, and then they just caught it. But if you are well prepared and you got well equipment, well team, then you got the, you know, like that emotional support, mental support, and also physical support. I think in a way, I think in hindsight, I think we did everything right. You know, every step, every moment, I think Hania and Harry work like, you know, he's giving everything and everyone gives everything. And that's probably what makes success.
But do you remember the moment when you found out that he reached the top of the world?
Yeah. It's like he called it from summit, even though it's hard, because it's so wind. I think when you were summiting like 3:30 p.m., which is like no one's there, too late for everyone. If you want to create the history, if you want to be a one, achieve something within the safety, there is no rules, you know. You make a rules as long as with the safe, you make your own rules. And this is the case for this one as well. A lot of the people and other thing, like they turn around, it's like, you know, if you are keep breathing, you got enough team, you got team going on with you, you got enough oxygen, even though, you know, like we got backup team coming up with you. So all you have to do is like, if you can just keep going until you collapse.
Do you remember what he said to you when he got to the top?
No, I think only thing we heard is like he obviously called.
He's screaming like,
yeah, it's like, yeah, I need more oxygen. Send the guys with oxygen. And we saw me that we're coming down. And it's like, great. So, and then he come down. But obviously there is always, you know, it's not easy. You know, there is so much of the, you know, like people are then on the way down. Sherpa has to, because he has to run out the oxygen, they has to come down. Then we have to send other guys. I think that's what the That's
you didn't have time to enjoy the moment.
Let's calm down, make sure it's safe. And then the greatest thing is we have like biggest team out of, you know, most deadly season. All the members safe, you know, everyone come back home. All the families in Serpas and local, and Harry and we are here. I think that's, you know, that's basically tell the story, I guess.
Well, you've led many expeditions over the years. And obviously that decision that you made at 300 meters to the top was to sacrifice your own chance to summit, but you trusted others enough to look after Harry, which is the sign of a good leader, I would say. What do you think makes a good leader?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think for me, it's there is a saying, you know, like true leader, neither be recognized nor to be known. You know, I think understand their not only the, you know, like physical aspect, but also emotional and then psychological and their soul part, you know. Are these the right guys? Are these the right people? And to support. And if so, then I think it has to be worth of your life. You know, I think that's the way I look. You know what? Actually, when I was decided who goes up and down, I didn't choose apart from two sick guys to go around. Everything they choose themselves. You know, I gave them opportunity. Right? You are eight of them here. Who wants to go up? And anyone who raised the arms, you go. And who are hesitating, you go down. Because I think for me, that is very important. You know, in a life. Whatever we do, and money and love and emotion only can push so far. When it comes to life and death, then life and death has to be decided. And
I wonder, with all that you've done, what do you do for fun?
I think for me is meditation is a great part of my life, and follow I wouldn't really call the kind of religion in such a way, but I think, like I said, now I spend 30 years, actually more than Buddhism. I spend more time in church now. Last week, believe or not, I was in church. And it just, you know, like reflect and realization and spending your time and every incident and accident. And also, it's always great to come back in home, you know, where your loved one is waiting for you and your loved one is around the world in those who are good human people. And there's always supporting you. I think we need to realize and reflect that. And for us being a human.
Finally, Krish, what other projects or ambitions lie ahead for you in the future?
Actually, working with quite a few disabled veterans. I've got another double amputees, first war blind, and the quite a few, you know, MND. We had a meeting as well with John, and there's a guy from Wales who wants to do, you know, for John Everest expedition, and those are my kind of in a kind of fixed project. But at the same time, I think my lot more focus is to share my service and my experience with the, you know, Buddhism philosophy, with the SAS mindset, and how to overcome, you know, all this, you know, run the mindful retreat in a way, packaging. And yeah, that's kind of, I'm start running in Lake District and in the Surrey Hill. I start running in Peterborough as well. And, you know, and also sharing a lot of, so actually next week I'm going to the engineers, Royal Engineers Army Cadet Center. And they were asking, oh, how can we overcome the through your mental adversity? So, you know, like just try to share these stories. And I think I realize now I'm living for someone else, giving their life. And I think these stories, I think we need to share and also inspire our new generation and soldiers and students to know, you know, it's worth living with the good intention.
Krish Thapa Mugha, thank you very much indeed.
No, thank you for coming all the way up, and, you know, hope we will spread this love and emotion for support our veteran and charity. And it's always been a pleasure to meet you and have a talk with you, mate.